Your Honors, and may it please the Court. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Lenny, wait just a minute. We're just changing a few bodies at the door and then we'll go.
But neither of these actually justified the dismissal. With respect to the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, the district court erred in two crucial ways. First, the court thought that my client was actually subject to some sort of vexatious litigant order while he was before the district court. That's simply not true. There was no such order in place. Indeed, any such order was removed by court order of the California courts in 1999, long before he filed this suit.
I saw the materials attached to your supplemental brief. Is that material in the record of the district court?
That material is not in the record of the district court, Your Honor. The state defendants asked the district court to take judicial notice of the fact that my client had been removed from the blacklist, but regretfully, the footnote in the district court opinion indicates that they had forgotten to file that motion to take notice, so those materials were not in front of the district court. Of course, we would argue that judicial notice is entirely proper in this court. Nonetheless, we're not asking for those documents to be admitted to the record. We would just like to, for this court to take notice, based on Federal Rule of Evidence 201, of this reason, this fact, which cannot reasonably be.
Isn't there some dispute about whether the list includes only pre-filing orders and not binding orders?
No, there's no dispute about that. According to CCP 391.7, I believe it's only the pre-filing orders that are subject to getting...
Right, so we could still be subject to bonding orders with regard to these cases he's complaining about, as far as the list is concerned. So why don't we get off just sticking to the complaint?
Sure. Absolutely, Your Honor. That'll work. Second, the district court thought that this suit principally challenged California's vexatious litigant statute, CCP 391, as applied to my client. But again, that's simply not the case. Fairly read, the complaint, we think, contains a broad facial challenge to that statute. And there's no Rooker-Feldman problem with that sort of challenge.
Suppose we thought that it contained both. It seems to me that the complaint does include a set of allegations which are not that he is currently subject to an order, but that he's being treated as if he were currently subject to an order. And that those, or at least some of those current cases, seem to be implicated by the relief, by some of the relief he's asking. But he also seems to have arguably has a broad facial challenge. So what do we have for Rooker-Feldman spin out then?
Your Honor, we would say that to the extent that Your Honor believes that there are those sorts of challenges, both as applied and facial in the complaint, we would respectfully disagree. But even if that is so, Your Honors, of course, in this circuit, pro se pleadings are to be construed liberally. And in this case, the district court didn't do that. And moreover, a liberal construction would, we think, allow my client to go forward with this case under just the broad facial challenge. There's precedent for that.
Now, this would be a liberal construction that reads things not into the complaint, but out of the complaint.
It's a fair point, Your Honor, but there's precedent for this sort of thing in Dubinka versus the judges of the Superior Court, this court's 1994 decision. At page 22, note 6, the court recognizes that there are some allegations in the complaint at issue in that case that might be taken to be as-applied challenges, and the court said, you know, to the extent that that's what's going on here, we don't deal with those, but the district court had jurisdiction to hear the appellant's facial challenges. Similarly, in Feldman itself, the Supreme Court held that there was no jurisdiction over the as-applied portion of the challenges, but there was, in fact, jurisdiction over the facial challenge. So certainly a remand to the district court just for my client to proceed with his broad facial challenge would be entirely appropriate.
Now, if part of this, and this is an if part of this suit is an as-applied challenge that is barred by Rooker-Feldman because it's a de facto appeal, is any part of the general constitutional challenge inextricably intertwined with the forbidden de facto appeal as part of my hypothesis that I've just given you part of this case?
Your Honor, we would respectfully submit that the court need not get to an inextricable intertwining, but because there is no such de facto appeal here. But under your hypothetical.
It would be helpful then if you tried to walk through some pieces of the complaint. Because
sure.
I do find it difficult to see. I mean, it says, for example, defendants conspired between December 9, 1999 and March 2000. They keep planning to fall from the vexatious litigant status so that we'll conduct the pursue the aforesaid six litigation. Now, that's not an allegation that he's on the list, but it's an allegation that he's been treated on the list, as if he's on the list, and the relief that he's asked for seems to ask him to eliminate that conspiracy or that attempt to treat him as if he's on the list. So there's some stuff in here that just seems to be about the current litigation and the way he's been treated in the current litigation.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
So why is that not a de facto appeal?
To be sure, Your Honor, there is some stuff that talks about the current litigation, but I think a fair reading of that stuff, I mean, again, keeping in mind that my client is a pro se litigant and that this pleading might not be as artfully drafted as it might have been, a fair reading of those allegations were that they were actually perhaps necessary just to achieve standing. I mean, if there's no chance that my client's ever going to be in a district court or a court at all, why would it matter if this is an effective
To substantiate standing with regard to the validity of the pre-filing vexatious litigant statute that he's being wrongly treated as subject to the vexatious litigation statute. So it seems to me there's another thread here other than the actual vexatious litigation statute.
To be honest, Your Honor, as I stand here, I'm not fully sure that I understand the section of the complaint entitled the conspiracy allegations. It might be fair to say that, in fact, this is just a pro se pleading, and it may not be unambiguous. But if you look at paragraph 31, for instance, there can be no doubt that this is a broad facial challenge. It's on page 16 of the supplemental excerpt. It reads, as established in Dubinka, which is this court's 1994.
I'm slow. What page are you on?
I'm sorry, page 16, Your Honor.
Page 16 of supplemental excerpts?
Yes, sir.
I've got excerpts. Well, I'll listen carefully.
Okay. In paragraph 31 of the complaint, it says, as established in Dubinka, this U.S. District Court has jurisdiction of this action of plaintiff here because it presents a broad general challenge to CCP 391, which does not require review of any state court decision in a particular case. It can't be more clear. Were there ambiguity in response to the several motions to dismiss filed in the district court in the record at number 126, my client made clear that this is in fact a broad facial challenge. He says the plaintiff is not asking this federal court to review any state court decision on any particular case, nor does this federal court have to review any state court decision on any particular case to determine whether or not the statute is unconstitutional on its face. And again, page 18 of that filing, plaintiff is asking this federal court to look at the statute on its face and to declare that on its face the statute is unconstitutional. These excerpts are set out in the reply brief at pages 5 and 6. He couldn't have been more clear. To be sure, the complaint is somewhat ambiguous, but it is certain that what is going on here is at its heart a broad facial challenge to the constitutionality of CCP 391. Turning to the Unger extension, I really don't have much to say other than the district court simply did not undertake a full analysis as required by this court's recent en banc decision in Green versus City of Tucson. Green describes as a threshold inquiry the question whether the relief plaintiff seeks would interfere with an ongoing state proceeding. There would be no such interference here. Interfere under Green means seeking to enjoin or declare invalid or otherwise involve federal courts in terminating or truncating a state proceeding. Mr. Wolf wasn't asking for the end of any state proceeding. Indeed, he was asking to go forward with his six state court litigations, free from the fear that this statute might be used against him. My opponents simply have no answer to the interference question. It's not mentioned in their briefs. I believe it's unanswerable. Your Honor, with respect, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I have one question. You used the term blacklist.
Yes, Your Honor.
To refer to this, your opponents took umbrage with that a bit. Has anybody ever called this list a blacklist before you did?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of whether they had or not. I think certainly under a legal dictionary definition it would be an adequate description, but to be intended was offensive, that was not intended. I'd be happy to just call it the vexatious litigant list for purposes of this case.
Was was the denomination of blacklist necessary to the intellectual formulation of your attack on the...
It's in no way necessary, and this court would rather deal with it as the vexatious litigant list, and I'm happy to just call it that, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Jill Bowers, and it's my privilege this morning to represent the State of California, the Judicial Council of California, the California Supreme Court Justice Ronald M. George, California Court of Appeal Presiding Justice Gary Strankman, and Judicial Council employee Deborah Silva. And I would like to advise the court that the co-defendant counsel and I are splitting the time, 10 minutes from me and 10 minutes from
me. Okay. We'll try to help you, but you please try to keep track also.
Yes, sir, I will. Your Honor, we believe that this case can be fully affirmed on grounds existing in the record with respect to the immunities these defendants are entitled to. None of the defendants in this lawsuit have the capacity to be sued on any theory advanced by this plaintiff, and remand would be futile in this case. There's no question that the State of California and the Judicial Council are not amenable to suit under Section 1983, and we would submit that on this record neither are the individual party defendants, because the plaintiff's allegations with respect to ex parte Young are simply insufficient.
What part does the Judicial Council play in the, let's call it, the administration of the list? Any part at all?
Only with respect to, as I understand it, Your Honor, in that they maintain the list. In other words, they get are advised of orders issued by the Superior Court, and then they put the list together and it make it available. But they are not the party making the decision whether or not somebody should be placed at the threshold on the list. So their functions
are only administrative. In other words,
administrative and ministerial.
There's no judicial decision making on the part of the council.
No, sir.
So where does immunity come in for an administrator in that context?
Well, Your Honor, we believe, and I apologize, we didn't cite this case in our brief, but we believe there is Ninth Circuit precedent to include the administrator in this judicial function under the protection of judicial immunity, and we would cite in that regard the case In Re Castillo versus Castillo. The citation for that is 297 F3rd 940, and in particular the pin site 946 to 949. In that case, the Ninth Circuit discussed the scope of judicial immunity, including as it includes non-judicial officers. In that particular case, judicial immunity was extended to the assistant of a standing Chapter 13 bankruptcy trustee who had made a docketing error, which ultimately resulted in the bankrupt party losing her house. And the court still found that assistant was entitled to judicial immunity.
But that was in the process of an adjudication, right? Here what we have is... Here what I think we have is a purely administrative task.
Well, the task of the assistant in the Castillo case was administrative in the sense that they were simply setting a date for a hearing.
Part of a judicial proceeding.
And giving notice.
Right.
And it was actually, I think, the failure to give the notice that caused the party not to appear.
But here what we have is something that's outside, as I understand it, outside any particular judicial proceeding. The task is putting together a generic list that applies in any judicial proceeding, and it doesn't have consequences unless and until such a proceeding is filed. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But we would still submit that the function of maintaining the list is analogous to docket control, the docket control issue in Castillo, and we would submit that would entitle the individual defendant.
Let me, you've been saying immunity, but there are various kinds of immunity.
Yes, sir.
And so far, I think I've been inferring that the immunity you're relying on is judicial immunity.
Yes, there's also...
With respect to the State of California and the Judicial Council, you may be on firmer ground arguing that it's the 11th Amendment.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. I apologize. I didn't...
But that, of course, doesn't get you as far as you want to get, because insofar as the individuals are being sued for injunctive relief, even though they are state officers, the 11th Amendment may not protect them under because of the theory of Ex parte Young.
Yes,
and can you help me understand why there is judicial immunity, not for a damage suit, I understand that, and this is not a damage suit. Is there judicial immunity from injunction under the theory of Ex parte Young or under some other, on some other basis?
No, Your Honor. The court has made it clear that there is no absolute judicial immunity with respect to injunctive relief. But, Your Honor, in this case, we would submit that the issuance of injunctive relief in this particular case is not called for because the plaintiff simply hasn't made the showing of extraordinary circumstances which would be necessary to reach that result.
And would you make the same argument if the relief sought were not injunctive relief but rather declaratory relief?
Yes, Your Honor, I would, because there is also precedent for the proposition that declaratory relief is as interfering in a state judicial process or in a civil proceeding as
And is the problem with respect to both injunctive relief and declaratory relief that it interferes with the operation of the state judiciary or that the harm is not sufficiently imminent? I mean, what's the theory as to why neither of those two is available?
Your Honor, I would submit both. And Samuel versus McHale is the case which suggests that it's the interference with the state proceeding that is prohibited by as its analysis. Your Honor, I did also want to...
I'm a bit confused. Could you give me some ballpark world in which this theory, which is not based on judicial immunity and not based on 11th immunity and not based on Younger versus Harris, what is it? Where is this theory coming from?
Your Honor, based in federalism constraints, and I would direct the Court's attention to a footnote. I think it's footnote 14 in the Virginia Supreme Court case, in which the court discussed it, although there's no absolute judicial immunity, the court discussed its reluctance to enter judicial relief, to enter injunctive relief against judicial process. And then that's what you have in this case, Your Honor. I think it's important to bear in mind that what this plaintiff is asking for is either the declaration that these judges made a mistake, that they were wrong to be biased against him and wrong to conspire against him, or that there should be a blanket prohibition against their ever being able to determine that he's a vexatious litigant. And for that reason, Your Honor, I think the federalism constraint in this case would suggest that the court should exercise caution in retaining
Should
that caution be exercised here or in the district court when we know what the record is? But what you have here is a complaint by a pro se litigant, which is basically incomprehensible. But maybe there's enough there, and if there is, wouldn't the judicial restraint have to follow what the district court finds out the facts are later? We don't know. Why would we restrain ourselves for something we can't really understand?
Well, Your Honor, I think the district court did fairly construe this plaintiff's complaint to include a direct challenge to a request for appellate review of a decision of Justice Strankman. And I would direct this court's attention to paragraph 6 of the complaint, in which he overtly complains about a decision of the Justice Strankman. Paragraph 6 of the complaint, paragraph 24, paragraph 26C, and paragraph 26D all involve plaintiff's allegations that he's disgruntled with the decision to place him on the vexatious litigant list, and also that there is a conspiracy aimed particularly at him to place him on the list. And we submit, Your Honor, that the district court fairly construed the complaint to contain, to be barred by Rooker-Feldman because he was asking the court to find that Justice Strankman had made a mistake and to find that these other justices were in error in conspiring against him.
The relief, however, that's prayed for, I mean, the complaint is sort of all over the place. The relief that's prayed for is somewhat less all over the place and does seem fairly focused on any facial challenge to the statute as a whole. So if we thought it contained both, I mean, in other words, if we thought that there at least is also a facial challenge in here, then what?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the facial challenge is inextricably intertwined with the conspiracy allegation. If you just look at the language that the plaintiff used, he says the conspiracy was and is aimed at plaintiffs specifically on the basis.
Well, it's a little odd because his conspiracy claim is that there wasn't a valid order against him, so it couldn't be very inextricably intertwined, which is a term I hate anyway, because his claim there is not that there's a facial problem with the statute, it's that the statute doesn't apply to him. So there are two things going on, two quite separate things in this complaint.
Well, Your Honor, we agree that the complaint is badly drafted, and the plaintiff never squarely
described. Well, even if it were quite well drafted, one is this statute's no good anyway, and I want it enjoined, and second of all, they're invalidly applying it to me right now.
Well, Your Honor, it appears to the state defendants that the plaintiff, although he never fairly, squarely describes the content of his six cases, it does appear that he fairly alleges that all of his six pending cases implicated the vexatious litigant statute, and so the answer to the threshold question in Green, whether relief requested would interfere with ongoing state judicial proceedings, seems to me on that basis to be yes. Because what he's asking for is a declaration that he should not be on the list, that it was erroneous to place him on the list. And in essence, he's asking for a license to pursue meritless claims.
But he says he's not on the list.
I mean,
he says in no uncertain terms that he's not on the list. They're just treating him like he's on the list.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the district court... If he's not on the list, if they're just, I think his allegations that they're treating him as if he were on the list are not substantive, they're not concrete. And so that would go to the question whether or not he's presented extraordinary circumstances under ex parte Young and Young.
Could you tell me where this extraordinary circumstance coming from?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the court's analysis in Younger versus Harris and progeny that look at the...
But that's not Younger. You're mixing doctrines up in a way that's very confusing to me. That's not ex parte Young, that's Younger versus Harris.
Yes, Your Honor. The inquiry under ex parte Young is whether the complaint alleges an ongoing violation of federal law and whether he seeks relief properly characterized as prospective. And in that respect, Your Honor, we would suggest that it's not clear in this complaint that he is alleging an ongoing violation of federal law. If you look at the kinds of cases where the court has found that that allegation was clear, for example, Verizon, there was a question in the context of clearly controlling federal law, possibly preempting the situation in that case, and that is also not the case here. And in addition, Your Honor, even issuing this plaintiff only declaratory relief would not be simply prospective. He's asking for declaratory relief, and the effect of that would not be simply prospective because he's asking for declarations that prior decisions of the court were wrong.
Okay. You're cutting fairly substantially into your co-counsel's time. Well, in response to our question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Could you put 10 minutes on the clock? Because it was our questioning that drove this over.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Let me hold you fairly tightly to the 10 you've got.
Actually, I think it could be substantially less for my part.
We'll be grateful for any gifts you might choose to make.
All right. My name is Jonathan Lee. I'm a deputy city attorney. I'm here on behalf of three state court judges. Our office represents. Much of the argument that I would have offered has already been ably presented by my colleague, my co-counsel. I just want to point out to the court that The three state court judges I represent, two of whom are now retired, by the way, are Judge Cantelli, who was the presiding judge at the time of the complaint was filed, and two law and motion judges, Judges Garcia and Petashak. The allegations against those three judges are an as-applied type of case. There's no other purpose for naming these judges in this complaint, as far as I can tell. If you look at in the excerpts of record on page 14, as has already been pointed out, the allegations are quite clear that the claim is being made that these three judges somehow conspired to use the vexatious litigant statute.
Well, two judges who are retired presumably are simply out of the case because he's only asking for injunctive and declaratory release.
Well, this is
so you might tell us who they are because it seems to me they're out.
This is one of the things I wanted to mention. Yes, it's Judge Cantelli retired from the bench. I think he's a mediator of jams now. And Judge Garcia is definitely a mediator of jams. Judge Petashak is still a law and motion judge. You may have seen him on the evening news here in the last couple of months. He's still been making some news here in some exciting cases. As a law and motion judge, he has no role under the vexatious litigant statute that would be an element of a broad challenge to that statute. He's simply a judge sitting in a law and motion courtroom waiting for parties litigant to bring in motions that they have disagreements about, and that's the only fashion or nature in which he's named in this suit. The allegation against Judge Petashak is that he refused to grant motions to recuse himself. That is neither part and parcel of a broad facial challenge to a statute or anything else that's of any relevance to this case. And so the dismissal, we're arguing, should be sustained with respect to Judge Petashak.
Well, how would you bring a broad facial challenge to this statute? Let's suppose that Mr. Wolf had done this all in a more orderly fashion than he did, and had come in and filed a complaint that said, I have been subject to this vexatious litigant statute in the past. I'm no longer subject to it. I don't have any immediate complaints, but I intend to file some more lawsuits in the future, and I am concerned that they are going to subject me to this statute again, and suppose we thought that was sufficient for standing, who would he sue?
Well, there are state law procedures. There are writs of mandate, writs of mandamus. There are state law remedies.
Why does it come to federal court?
Well, if there's no pending litigation involving the issues, and you just simply want to challenge in federal court a law, I suppose that you can do that. But here we've got the Rooker-Feldman
Right.
We've got
also. I'm trying to figure out. I mean, because the argument today has made me wonder about this. Who would he sue? Is there any? If he couldn't sue any particular judges, which is your argument, because no particular judge is responsible for the overall enforcement of the statute, and then we're being told he can't sue the Judicial Council because it's the government, and that may well be right, he can't sue the state. Is there anybody he can sue?
When you take a writ of mandate in an ongoing state action, you are naming the Superior Court as the real party in interest, because that happens all the time. And when parties dispute the court's ruling.
That wasn't my question. I asked if in federal court, if he wanted to bring a challenge to this overall statute as a First Amendment problem or something, is there any viable way to put together a lawsuit like that?
I don't know. I
don't. You mean you don't want to be his lawyer?
No.
I'm not asking you. It seems to me that the different arguments that are being made here preclude any lawsuit of this kind.
Well, in this posture where you had six ongoing cases in state court, you shouldn't be able to jump to federal court's review decision.
I know, but I set it up because that you didn't have the six cases.
Yes.
And how about the posture where he has no ongoing cases? He has been prevented in the past, but he's no longer on the list. He has good reason to fear that if he starts to file again, he will be on the list again. You say your particular judges can't be sued because, well, two of them have retired and are no longer hearing cases at all, and the other one's on law and motion and if a suit is filed, it's not going to come before him. Well, and of course, he hasn't filed any suits yet, so we don't know the judge before whom the case will come. if he files a suit, I assume you're going to argue that's barred by Rooker-Feldman because all of a sudden we got the suit. Is the consequence of your argument that he simply can never bring suit in federal court to challenge on federal constitutional grounds the state vexatious litigation statute?
I was only dealing with the posture that we had here. I would never want to say never.
We're trying to figure out where this leads, and it sounds as though it may lead to never.
I think given these facts, I would say that he had no recourse in federal court. Obviously, that's my argument. But in a vacuum, can a litigant challenge state law in federal court? There has to be a way. My gut level reaction is there has to be a way to do it. But I don't know if that's our record, or our facts here, and I don't think that it is.
Okay, but you're representing only these three judges?
Correct, yes.
And two of them have retired, and they're working for JAM, so they're not likely to be recalled and so on?
Correct.
And the other is on law motion. Do we know how long he will be on law motion? I don't understand the internal procedures of the state court well enough to know if that's going to get in next year.
I believe it's a two-year stint, and I think he's midway, a little bit more than midway through his 2 year.
But you're not really saying it's because he's on law motion. You're basically saying that any individual judge who does not presently have a case before him is not an appropriate person to be sued.
That's right. I'm saying that the appropriate way to take this issue up would have been either through a writ of mandate, a writ of mandamus, which gets you immediate relief in the Court of Appeal, or to take it up as part of your appeal of the six cases.
And you're the only, but of course, it does not escape our notice that the only procedures that you're outlining are in state court.
Well, I believe that was the underpinning of Rooker-Feldman, that the state court systems stand as separate systems at which the head of, you have the Supreme Court. So there is the federal protection throughout, it's federalism.
Well, we've got many overlapping doctrines that are premised upon the federal system, Rooker-Feldman being only one of them, and Rooker-Feldman says at its core you cannot appeal from a state court judgment to a lower federal court.
Right.
But I don't think there's a state court judgment out there at the moment from which an appeal is being taken.
Well, but that would leave us with the ability to go to federal court for a ruling on a motion. And I think we don't want federal courts to be veritable mini-marts of adjudication.
Of course.
It would be nonsensical to permit a party to jump to federal court just because they don't like the ruling on a motion, which is what we have here.
At most, in part, it may be in part what we have here, but it may not be
everything. Well, there may be, it's an 80-some page complaint, and there may be somewhere in there.
It's not somewhere in there. It's a prayer for relief, almost exclusively.
But I think your point on the motions, Judge, is that he files a complaint in state court. Somebody files a motion against it, and he goes before a motion judge, and there's a ruling that a challenge to that judge has to be under Rooker-Feldman because there's nothing else going on between this plaintiff and the system.
Right.
All right.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank both counsel on that side. Mr. Murray?
Your Honor, my colleagues have offered you a whole bunch of different alternative grounds for affirmances, both in their briefs and in their affirmative arguments. Just to get a little bit back to Rooker-Feldman and Younger abstention.
Let's not get back to Rooker-Feldman. let's deal with what they said. The state, whether here or later, is going to get out on 11th Amendment grounds.
Absolutely.
All right. Mr. Judicial Counsel?
That's actually pending before this court in another case. We don't know the answer to that.
Okay. But possibly. So then what? Who are the appropriate defendants in this case?
It's a question I've pondered about myself, Your Honor, and I think for a pro se litigant, Mr. Wolf did really quite an interesting job of coming up with this case. It strikes me that the approach he's taken is absolutely correct. Here's what he did. You have a state legislature that's passed what we believe to be an unconstitutional statute. Certainly you can't sue the legislature. Typically, if it were like a criminal statute, you'd sue the enforcing authority. You'd go after the attorney general and an expert, a Young sort of suit.
Mm-hmm.
But the executive doesn't play any role in enforcing the statute. The people who enforce the statute under CCP 391.7...
But your problem may... Everything may turn on the judicial council, because the judicial council seems to be the administrator. If you can't have them, maybe even have somebody in the judicial council's office as an ex parte Young, but what the judges don't seem appropriate.
Well, Your Honor, 2 points to that. First, yes, there is someone in the Judicial Council office. My client sued Deborah Silva as the person who administers the office. The second, the judges do administer it in a way that's very relevant here. Under CCP 391.7, the judges have the ability not only in response to a motion, but also on their own motion, to impose a pre-filing order.
Okay. Have any of these judges who are actually sued done that? Is there any reason to think they're going to do it in the future?
As against my client, there are reasons to believe that they might do it in the future. Have these particular judges done it? I don't know whether these particular judges have done it. Is there reason to believe that they might do it? Sure, because
it's fairly speculative. We have to believe that he's going to file a case in their court and it's going to be assigned to them, and then they're going to impose
I actually disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the gravamen of the allegations about the 6 ongoing state court litigations is, in fact, that he's in court, that he's appeared before some of these judges, and that there's a risk that they might be applying this to him. That said, there was no such order in effect against him at the risk of trying to murder fall on the ground, and I just want to be clear about that.
In a nutshell, what's your best shot at why Mr. Lee's 3 clients should remain in this case, given what they have done relative to the plaintiff?
Well, Your Honor, the arguments Mr. Lee has made here today that 2 of the judges retired are brand new to me. I would be hard to
assume that for the purpose of the record, that's not true. They're all sitting there doing their duty.
Okay.
Why are they going to stay in the case?
Absolutely. So what my client did, since there wasn't an executive branch to go after, he went after the people who administer and enforce this statute by, on their own motions, entering these sorts of orders, or at least in a capacity to do that. So he sued the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court in an individual and a representative capacity. That's in the complaint. He sued Justice Strachman in the appellate court, the mid-level, in an individual and representative capacity. He sued law and motion judges. He sued trial judges. He's trying to make sure that he's bound up in this suit everyone who might enforce this statute against a litigant such that he will get complete relief. The statute will not be enforceable, and he can get a full declaration of its unenforceability because it's unconstitutional. He does that, of course, through the fiction of Ex parte Young, which allows this sort of suit against an administrator seeking only prospective injunctive relief. To the extent that the complaint might be read to look for something else, I believe there's an extraneous allegation in there about wanting restoring all rights to him and to anyone else who's had a problem under the statute. Again, that could be easily amended in an excise complaint. The gravamen, as Your Honor pointed out, in the prayer for relief, there's no request for damages here. There's a request for injunctive relief. There's a request for a declaration. Not a declaration that the judge made mistakes, but a declaration that this statute is unconstitutional.
But I'd like to come back to Judge Nelson's question, and this may be the same question or maybe a variation on the question. He sued a number of different judges, but it's not at all clear that if he files again, and if the filing is assigned to a judge, it will go to these judges. It will go to a judge. But in fact, even if he files in San Francisco, the odds are against it going in front of these particular judges, even if they're not retired, just because there are a lot of judges over there. So, are they proper defendants?
I absolutely think so, Your Honor, and here's why. One of the allegations that you'll find within the complaint is a First Amendment allegation where he alleges that the gravamen of what he's concerned about here is the chill about his ability to file future litigation. Certainly my client is no stranger to the California courts, and were he to go in there, it might well be assigned to one of these judges or one of their fellow judges on their courts, which is, again, why he sued these judges in both an individual and a representative capacity. To be sure, he could go back and sue every judge in the state of California. If that is the proper result under...
He might be able to limit it to San Francisco by saying that's where he intends to file if he files.
So he could do that as well. If that's the proper course under what this court believes, then certainly that would be possible in the complaint to get that done.
Is it possible that he can get complete relief not by suing any of the judges, but rather by suing Ms. DeSilva, whom he has named, who worked, I gather, for the Judicial Council?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think not, because her only role, as I understand it, is to compile this blacklist based on orders. Pardon me, Your Honor. The vexatious litigant list. Her role is to compile that list based on orders that have been put in place either on motion or on their own motion by these judges. She is purely an administrator of the list. She does not control whether these
orders. What role does Chief Justice George play here? That is to say, is he sufficiently in charge of the system as an administrator, that complete relief could be accorded in an order against Chief Justice George?
As far as I understand, he presides over California's Judicial Council. But I don't know that he would be in a position in a day-to-day basis to enter these sort of issues against a litigant. I believe he could.
Is this something, if we allow the suit to go forward, despite the Rooker-Feldman arguments and despite the Younger versus Harris arguments, do we need to take evidence in the district court as to what the responsibilities are of these various people and what relief might be available against each of these people?
Well, I think Your Honor has put your finger right on the point, and perhaps I've been trying to answer the question a little bit too thoroughly. The answer is we don't know the answers to a lot of these questions because the suit was dismissed on a motion to dismiss. The only reference to the 11th Amendment in the district court's opinion is that the district court had grave doubts as to whether the suit would be permissible as against the state of California, which I believe Judge Berzon is quite right, it's probably not, and as against the Judicial Council of California, which is in front of this court now in a separate proceeding. There's no commentary as to whether it's appropriate against any of the other judges. I can try to answer why I think it is, but certainly this court need not reach that in order to remand on the two issues the district court did address, Rooker-Feldman and Younger abstention. If the panel has nothing further.
Thank you very much. We thank all three counsel for very useful argument in a complex area and making that complex area interesting. Now, the case of Wolf v. Strankin is now submitted. The next case is United States v. Woodard, and we'll wait a minute for the room to rearrange.